Hello everyone, it's Ray here, and I'm with Toby. He was in New Zealand, I'm actually in Australia. So how are you, Toby?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's another beautiful day here in the Wairarapa.
Well, that's great. So we were just following our first little podcast. We thought we'd do another one. But before we start on that, how's your work week been so far, Toby?
It's been very different. We've had a lot of rain over here throughout the week, and so the thought of getting any picking done was somewhat dashed. But true to form, it's all the sun's out, and it's a good forecast for the next few days. So we're gonna let the grapes hang for a couple of days, and then we're gonna pick some Pinot Noir on Friday.
Now, something tells me that you now know we have two vineyard dogs, or one vineyard dog left, sadly. Clan passed away, didn't he, just a few months ago, but you now know how Cato feels about going for a walk.
Yes. Yep, I go, maybe a little too much walking at the moment. I go out two or three times a day around the vineyard. There are people out there. There are people also like myself who are going for quick strolls with the dogs or just to get some fresh air. So we exchange conversation from about 6 or 7 meters away, and then we retrench down the rows and get back to the house.
So I have this vision of Toby in the house washing his hands a gazillion times, and and then perhaps going up to the window, looking out the window, and then if he sees Jake and Dylan out for a walk, Toby then starts yelping and almost barking, just as if Cato was you now. I'm starting to even act like Cato, are you, Toby?
I am. My tongue hangs out most of the time. My nose is quite wet, so.
How's Jake and Dylan doing?
They're doing very well as well, yeah. Yeah, we're keeping very busy. There's lots of things that we haven't been able to get to, and now we're getting to. So we're keeping ourselves pretty occupied most of the time.
Yes, and when I check in, some of our listeners might be aware that, again, I check in with Toby and the boys and see what they're up to every day. And I have this vision of Toby with his apron on doing cleaning and hoovering. And you've been doing a bit of that, a bit of domestic stuff, haven't you?
I have become very domesticated again. So, there's always something to do, that's for sure.
And you've got your own personal chef there in the form of Dylan.
We have, yeah. He's obviously got the DNA from his mother's side, your side of the family, because I struggle with beans on toast, and he's turning out some lovely dishes. And it may come at some point that I actually start getting a bit podgy, so we'll see how that works out.
I think your listeners, I mean, when the restaurant opens again, I think they might find this 300-pound Toby greased in the mic. So it's a funny image as well. So we had some good feedback to the first one, and there seems to be an appetite. People seem to enjoy it. But before we start on it, Toby, I'm sure we'd like to wish all our clients and friends and listeners well, and we hope you're not finding it too distressing and that you're coping as well during this lockdown period. Hey, Toby.
Yeah, and it's nice. We're getting a few messages coming through again now from people once they settle into to the lockdown themselves, looking for things to do, and a lot of people sending nice messages to us, and obviously we're responding, so keep them coming. It's really lovely to hear from you all.
And so Toby, I thought maybe today maybe the topic could be through the seasons. I think a lot of the folks and the listeners might find it interesting to just seasonally, just to take us through the year, and maybe we can talk about behind the scenes, everything in broad terms that goes into bringing this gift from God, this bottled poetry, as Robert Louis Stevenson called it, wine to you through the cellar door of the restaurant. And so right now, let's assume that the harvest has happened, Toby. And so after the harvest, what is the routine for you?
Well, funnily enough, actually, what we do is we kind of give the vines, the vineyard, a chance to relax and unwind, because it's had a very stressful summer, you know, lots of heat and a lot of pressure on the vines. So what we do is once the grapes are picked, it's kind of giving the vines a chance to catch up with everything. And so they've obviously got to shed leaves, and they've obviously got to The sticks have got to sort of lose a bit of greenery and go brown. And so we give them a few weeks, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, where we don't do anything other than maybe give them a strop of a bit of water if there's no rain and just let them recover.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting. We philosophically don't irrigate. And so, as Toby rightly says, the vines, they have actually a cardiovascular system, not a nervous system, but they're living things, and they work so hard throughout the year, and we purposely don't water them to force the roots to dig deeper and deeper to get the properties of the soil, the trace elements, the minerals. And and as Toby rightly says, at the end of that year, they're totally exhausted. And it's interesting, eh, Toby, the colors of the leaves. A lot of people think it's autumnal colors, and it certainly is that. But it's interesting, once you pick the grape and harvest is completed, the leaves turn brown and shed, don't they? And they shut down in a way, through their exhaustion.
They really do. I know you took us actually on a family holiday to Canada in the autumn, and it was something I'd never experienced before, and the colours were just breathtaking, and there were reds and oranges and golds and browns. Every single tree was changing colour, and it looked so lovely. And when I got back to Martinborough, it was reminiscent of that at the same, you know, it was just beautiful to see that happening. But yeah, like you say, the flip side to that is the vine shutting down and getting itself ready for what comes next.
That's right. And coincidentally on this, that because as well as a business, it's a very spiritual process, living off the land and with Mother Nature and Mother Earth and all that entails. So we give thanks to the powers to be for the blessings of the harvest and to the community and to ourselves, and really pay homage to Mother Earth during the times where the vines are having their bonus kind of water, and we're then celebrating the miracles of Mother Nature, really, and spiritually giving thanks for that harvest. And it's very special, eh?
It really is. I think it's all our favourite time of the year, you know, to see the crop coming in, to see the vines as you take the fruit, to see the changes within them themselves, but also, yeah, just to see that fruit coming off and the vine, the vineyard after that's all gone. It's a very peaceful place. It's a lovely place to be.
And so we leave them for, actually prior to leaving them, you then take the nets off, don't you?
Yep. So yeah, we have a little team, i.e. me and one of the boys. Usually that's our task for the year, is to take the nets off. So we basically tidied the place up. So the nets coming off, there's no risk of birds eating anything because they've all gone. So we just tidy everything up and shut everything down.
And then we leave the vines for usually, say, harvest ends kind of March, April. So May, June, July, it's dormant, the vineyard, isn't it?
That's right, yeah, yeah. Gives it we want to see all the leaves falling off. Every single leaf should be gone, and there should be no green shoots or anything showing other than brown canes, which means that they're ready for the pruning to start.
And that's an interesting, so if any of the listeners are gardeners, they'll prune roses. You can imagine, I don't know, goodness, how many vines, probably 100,000 rose bushes to prune. But Toby then, in the old days, but when I was young, I used to do the first cuts, but Toby now, I've passed that baton on to Toby, and you do the first cuts, and it's all done by hand, actually. That's very important, that, you know, when we say it's handcrafted and handmade and boutique and artisan, it literally is, there's no other way of doing it. So it's life as it was, a mirror into history, really. I mean, how life used to be, isn't it, Toby? Very slow, very, 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 very special, literally hands-on. So you do the first cuts, and then explain the process, Toby. What happens?
Well, again, with the first cut part of that, just for people who aren't familiar with the process, is literally that you're you're making decisions on which of the canes will be the ones you use for next year, which ones will be the leaders for all of the growth that comes next. So you, when you're doing the first cuts, you're picking not only that year, but you're also thinking about other years coming, because you're shaping the vine at the same time. But once you've done the first cuts, there's obviously quite a lot of debris, a lot of leftover that needs to be removed. And that process is called stripping out. And within that process, it can be quite arduous, quite hard going for the person doing that job. But the key thing is to get all of the extra cane, the dead cane, everything that's not going to be used, away from the chosen canes. And so that process can take quite a time. So that's the first two parts to pruning. So the first cuts and then the stripping out.
And then the tying down.
The tying down process is where you've made your decisions. You've got a few choices. You don't just chop everything off and just leave a couple of choices. You give yourself some backups, and so you perhaps would leave maybe 4 or 5 canes. You would tie down on the wire the two that you choose. And if somewhere along the way, maybe one gets snapped, or when you're making the choice, you decide the other one's better, you've got backups. And then those are the ones that are laid down, and those are the ones that will become the new cycle, the new vintage.
So that's a good overview, Toby. And then once you've completed that process, how long does that take? Again, the listeners will be interested to know. It's a lengthy process, isn't it?
It is a lengthy process, and obviously a lot of it is weather dependent. So, for instance, the one job that is very weather dependent is the first cut, because when you do the first cut, you therefore expose the interior, the inside of the vine, to the outside elements. So therefore, cutting in the rain isn't a good option, because you can get all kinds of bacteria, all kinds of disease can be formed on an open cut. Much like if you cut yourself, you probably want to get a plaster on or some form of covering. So with the pruning, the first cut can be done on a clear day, a windy day, a sunny day. It can't be done when it's raining. So that is the only job that's weather dependent. But if you had a perfect run, it would probably take to do this vineyard about 386 man hours or woman hours, depending on who's doing it.
A long time. It's and it seems to take forever, doesn't it? But and to paint the picture that our team, when they're out there, they get wrapped up warm. Obviously, it's very cold as well. That's the other thing, because it's through the winter, and you listen. You've got you listen to your earphones and music and whatever. But it's a very solid tree. Very again silent. It's interesting. It's back to nature. It's life at 1 mile an hour, isn't it? Really.
It really is. And the nice thing is, again, yeah, you can lose yourself out there if you want to. It's like I suppose it's a bit like some form of therapy. If you want the peace and quiet. I personally don't listen to music at all, but a lot of the people do. We get befriended often by the fantails. They tend to like us when we're pruning. They tend to spend a lot of time buzzing around us. They've got their own little music soundtrack. So I find myself watching them, listening to them, and just drifting off every now and then. But certainly, if you want to have conversation, that's a nice way to do it as well. If you're working opposite someone, there's lots of choices to be made.
And then the next part, round about, when would it be? Usually September-ish, isn't it? September, October, is bud burst.
Yes. Yeah.
Explain what that is, Toby.
Well, that again is a blessing. It's a double-edged sword, really. You get the bud burst, which is always lovely. It's very exciting to see, because in effect, once you've laid the canes down and they're dormant, it feels like the vintage is never going to start. But of course, the vintage actually does start about the second week of September, and it's very lovely to see the new growth. You see sort of a sudden activity across the entire vineyard with little green buds bursting. But what also happens is that ties in with some of our heaviest frosts. during the season. And so these vines, which up until that point, I remember you said, Ray, they were like the Terminator. You know, you could run them down, blow them up, run anything, and they just keep bouncing back. But the minute those new buds burst, they become like babies, and they need 24-hour attention, and they need to be protected, especially from the frost.
That's right, because they're very vulnerable. If the frosts come, that they can get burnt, really, and then the new growth is really burnt and dies. Otherwise, they're very hardy. The plant of a vine is very strong and resilient, but as Toby said, they're very vulnerable at this particular time. And so, wow, in the old days, they would have haystacks and fires and do all kinds of things to try and fight the frost. These days in Marlborough, it's interesting that, as well as other parts of the world, they have been very innovative and inventive, and we get a lot of helicopters, as a lot of our listeners, maybe locals, will recall. It's like Vietnam, isn't it? I mean, or Miss Saigon with all the choppers coming in. And explain to those who may not be aware of why, what that's all about, Tobe.
Yeah, well, actually, like the helicopters, there's also the windmills, people often ask if those windmills are to generate electricity, but they're not. They're solely used for frost protection, and they're generated by diesel. So they have a sensor monitor dotted around the vineyard, and when the temperature drops to a certain point, those windmills will start. And again, much like the helicopters, they're triggered by a phone call from the vineyard owners to come and start hovering over the vineyard. What they actually do in that process is they create an artificial inversion layer, which basically at 15 meters above the ground, up until a certain temperature, there is a band of warm air. And what we can't do on the ground without the use of helicopters and windmills is bring that warm air down. So all windmills are set at about 15 meters in height, and the helicopters are able to dodge and dive and duck all over the vineyard and push the warm air down. So that in turn pushes away the frost to a certain point. And I think, Ray, you'll probably be the one, because you were the one that took it on the chin in 2007, where we had some of the worst frosting in Martinborough's history.
It's an interesting dilemma, really, that living with Mother Nature and living off the land, I have different views on it. And you used to use diesel bins as well, Toby, didn't you? That used to shoot out huge flames, like flamethrowers, you know, remember?
That's right, yeah. I remember actually when we first arrived at the vineyard, and you had suggested that we look at different ways of stopping the frost from affecting the vines, and we put on our investigative hats and came up with frost pots, diesel bins at the time, and we bought a handful. We didn't buy massive amounts. We bought enough, we thought, to cover the vineyard. And the concept behind that was the opposite to the windmills and the helicopters. It would actually create warm air from the ground up. So we would have, I think at that point we had about 75 of them dotted across the one block here. And the task on that night would be to get them all lit at a point to enable them to create a blanket of warm air that would cover the vineyard and keep the frost away.
And interesting that at that time, the Tirahana Colonial House was a vine stay, and that we used to get people desperate to book into the house. And we'd say, look at frost, you're probably not going to get any sleep because of the noise of the helicopters and the activity. And people said, but that's why we're booking in, which is amazing. So to them, we'd give them blankets and they'd sit under the starlit sky, the bitter cold, there's the frost, and watch this spectacle that visually was literally like part hell, with all these fires, the frost spots and helicopters hovering and swooping like aliens almost, you know, with their night sun beams beaming down and different lights. And then to keep them flying, you'd have different, trucks going up and down the road. And you'd hear voices meaning to calling out disparate voices, people stopping to, it's a great community where everybody, you'd be in the vineyard and you'd have some of your neighbors fighting the frost who would stop and ask if you're okay, if you needed help, eh?
Yeah, actually, I think what some of my favorite times at the beginning were where we would all be here during frost, that you'd be here and Adam would be here and Saran and Linda, we'd all be down here in the vineyard, and you'd be giving me pointers and telling me what I needed to be doing. I remember my first night where I just did it on my own, and we had a phone call. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. From at that point, we had a weather station that could talk. It would wake me up and tell me what point and where I would need to be. So I remember dashing down one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to pinch myself because it was getting close to zero anyway. And I was standing under this unbelievable planetarium sky, and all around me I could see helicopters with their flashlights buzzing all the vineyards, and like you say, you could hear people's voices and panic, and there were some pretty strange things going on as well, different people with different ideas on how to maintain the frost. And my favorite was one of the neighbors who would wear a temperature controlled light on his head and walk around the vineyard. So at one point it would be green, and then it would flash red when he got to a point where it was cold. Then he would know what he would call the helicopter on his walkie-talkie and get him to bring it over. But I do remember that first night that I was on my own and just trying to get the diesel bins to light, and I was having no luck at all. And literally out of nowhere, like a guardian angel, this strapping huge fellow appeared with a blowtorch and some gauze and showed me again how to do these diesel bins, and then just disappeared. Even to this day, not quite sure I know who it was, but it was an amazing night. And 75 diesel bins, I was beating my chest like the alpha male. It was the most incredible night, and no frost damage.
The reason Toby was on his own was that if we didn't book into the house, we didn't have a place to stay. So we'd end up staying in the hotel, like sheer luxury, I mean, in the warmth. And we'd phone Toby on the cell phone. And so Toby would be out there with his teeth chattering and freezing. And we'd be kicking him out saying, get on with it, you know, get a hot water bottle. And we'd be there with our cocoa and in the bed, you know, with our earmuffs all nice and cozy. And he'd be left alone. But after a while, it's interesting, going back to your original question, Toby, that I became aware that, you know, in the end, you can't fight Mother Nature and you can't control Mother Nature, and that you almost have to put it into your business plan because it will only make you ill. And I became aware that it was a very stressful time for Toby. So what we do now is literally nothing. We just go to bed with our hot water bottle, and we have to take it on the chin. If we get frosted, we get frosted. And again, there's no reason in worrying about it. And that's what I've said in business. And I mean, I feel sorry for some businesses that really, you know, suffer from it. But we try and underwrite it and write it in and if we don't get frosted, it's a bonus. But we try and look out for the worst case and assume that we're going to lose a little bit every year to the frost. And that we just think is part of the pain of being in the industry that we're in, living off the land, because you cannot control it.
No, it's certainly one of the many elements that we've learned along the way. And certainly, again, when you think who is in charge, I remember when I first started thinking that I was in charge of how the vines, when they would grow, what they would do. But the reality is that they do what they want to do, and we fall into place.
That's right. Mother Nature controls it, really, and that's who we all work to, and there's nothing that we can do about it. Just like this situation with the global world, I mean, that we're all in lockdown and the best laid plans, you know, you can never plan too far ahead and take things for granted, and you know, that you know, you can kind of in the end, you know, some greater power than us or destiny or fate, or call it what you like. I mean, we just have to accept that, and it's a great leveler, really. It brings you down to earth, and you realize that, you know, you control your destiny in some ways, certainly, but in other ways, there's something greater, and if you worry about it, you'll get ill or get cancer or ulcers, and the best thing is just to accept it. And acceptance, I think, is as powerful as those helicopters and the windmills, Toby, and the diesel bins. We just accept that we will, on time to time, lose some of the vines or the, yes, the buds. And so that's the first hurdle. I mean, that's almost the easy part. And then following that, Toby, you put the nets on as the vine, the little buds, when they burst and those buds grow and the leaves come, and they grow so fast. It's almost like you can see it daily, can't you, Toby?
You can. It's like watching one of those stop motion, you know, where it's done over a period of time, and then you play it back and watch it fast forward. Some days you look and you can almost see the growth happening. And it's amazing because there's a lot of tasks between the first bud burst and when we put the nets on at the end of January. There's bud rubbing, there's crown thinning, there's wire adjusting, all of these things, ways of containing the growth and keeping it all under control, because vines by nature are climbers and they want to reach out, they want to entwine with the neighboring vines. And it always reminds me of that scene in Sleeping Beauty where the Prince Charming is hacking his way through the vines to get to the castle. And if you left them, that's literally what would happen. They would make their way across and it would just become one big vine. So there's a lot of work that goes in between the second week of September and the end of January.
And just going through those tasks, Toby, to explain to the listeners, bud rubbing, what does that mean?
Well, bud rubbing means you're going to get a terrible backache. That's what it means, because it's a hideous job, I have to say. But it's so important because the vines, again, are learning ways to grow. They'll be growing off the canes, but they're also being rather sneaky and growing at the bottom of the trunk. And what that does is that draws away goodness and energy from the areas that we need to be centering on. So the bud rubbing is literally, as it sounds, it's getting rid of those buds. And because we do all of this by hand, you just need a very sturdy pair of gloves and a strong back, or a group of young, naive people who don't actually know what the task is.
Like our grandson, my grandson. I mean, it's wonderful. You just and they would go out, and I'd say, look, this is, when you're older, you look back on these days, it's the happiest days of your lives. And they'd look at me like I was crazy, eh, Toby?
They do. And then the jobs that follow that are crown thinning, where basically around the core, Ray talked of the cardiovascular, which is the central part of the trunk. Everything sort of congregates or everything sort of emanates from there. That area becomes quite clustered and quite full of growth. And also on the canes, you're going to have new shoots forming that won't actually bear any fruit. And at that point, you can actually see what needs to be there and what doesn't need to be there. So you're thinning out the area around the trunk, and you're thinning out the extra doubles, the ones that are not going to produce fruit. And that gives you a clean vine, which will then grow and keep the airflow working. So you won't end up with disease or too much leaf.
And then we do the wire adjusting, and that occurs quite regularly. And that's, as you say, you lift the wires so the vines can climb onto the mate.
Yeah, that's right. And you move them maybe four times over the season, maybe sometimes five. There's also, and that's basically what you're doing, is you're containing them, because again, they will just make their way out. And they still do. There's still another job, as well as moving the wire adjusting. You also, you're also tucking, which is basically keeping any rogue canes that might be escaping. You're tucking them back in under. So it's a constant cycle, constant workload.
And then round about December, kind of late December, January, we then do a task known as leaf plucking, eh?
Yeah. And another job that is incredibly important. We often liken it, if you were to come to the vineyard at, say, the beginning of December, you'd see the vines would be very sort of fall looking, like fall bushes. If you come at the end of December, they've been given the equivalent to a buzz cut, but we've done this by hand. And what we've done is we've taken away the leaves from around the actual grapes themselves. Now, the different varietals require different volumes, different percentages of leaf removed. The Pinot Noir likes 100% of the leaf removed from around the grapes. But what you must do is leave a large volume of leaf above the grapes to give for photosynthesis. Some of the whites are quite receptive. They react differently to too much sunshine. So Sauvignon, for instance, becomes very sweet if exposed to too much sunshine. So you take away less of a percent. So if you've got 100% on Pinot Noir, when you do the Sauvignon, you would take away, I think, what's the percentage we say, Ray? About 70% for the afternoon sun and more for the morning sun. So when the sun's on the vines in the morning, it's a weaker sunshine. So you can afford to take away, say, sorry, I've got that back to front, 70% of the leaves can be taken away at that point. When it gets to the other side of the vine in the afternoon, it's very intense. So you probably need to leave more cover. So I think you did the first recipe that you created for the Sauvignon was 70% on the morning and 30% on the afternoon. And that's how we create those flavors on the Sauvignon that you drink here at Tirohana.
So you can almost, it's almost like cooking in a way that you can, as Toby said, alter the flavors. And I think that's an important, it's an old fashioned, I mean, some of the conventional winemakers might think it's nuts, but I subscribe to the old world, the old ways of doing things, the traditional ways. And I kind of like that, you know, to individually, I mean, each vine, we know them, don't we, Toby? And we like to protect them. And it's also for disease, as Toby said, you know, you can get lots of from leaf. What are some of the ones we get?
Well, powdery mildew is a terrible one to get, because if you get it early in the season, you need to be constantly controlling it, and it involves a lot of work, a lot of sprays and all kinds of things you don't really want to do. So that's why we're very diligent early in the season for that not to happen.
And we spray with sulfur, so we get as organic as we can be, but we do have to counter some now and then and do some sprays, don't we?
We do. Another one we use a lot of is seaweed, which is a great nutrient. But you can imagine with sulfur and seaweed, it sometimes is quite reminiscent of Rotorua here on a good summer's day. It can be quite sort of stinky, but it's all wonderfully, the vines absolutely love the seaweed that we put on it. We sometimes put calcium on and all kinds of different things added, but mostly sulfur.
That's right. And then the next task, I suppose, is putting the nets on, isn't it?
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like that long ago we were taking them off. So, but the nets go on because, again, up until a certain point, the grapes are very unattractive to the birds. When there's a little sequence of events that happens that where obviously that you go through flowering and capfall, all of those things happen to get you to where the grapes are actually forming. And up until the end of January, they're very, very tart, very acidic. There's no flavor. There's no reason for anything to want to eat them. At the end of January, the first sugar, also known as veraison, arrives in the grapes. And then suddenly these become like a drug to these birds. They just can't get enough of them. And so what you find is that they start eating the grapes. And so therefore the nets need to go on as quickly as possible to protect those grapes. So that's a task that, again, we do by hand, and it takes a good chunk of time. But it's an essential part of the process at that time of the year.
That's right, and then that's when the Pinot grapes start to change colour and to go into the deep purple almost. I mean, the black, and some of them are extraordinary. But it's interesting, again, in Mother Nature, you can almost, you can look when the hawks are flying around, you know that, because everything is so interconnected. And, in the old days, I'd pick up a handful of soil in my hand and speak to the grandsons, and show them how all those bugs in the soil do something, and they're something you don't normally, when they're on their computers and when we're rushing from airports or to the office or to pick up the kids from school or go on holiday, in the fast-paced material world, we've lost sight of that. And that's why I do love Tirana, because it brings you back to nature and to this natural world, this Mother Earth, and the miracles of it. And so really, when you see the hawks, you know that the birds are going to be coming, and the birds are going to be coming because they, just like any consumer, they love the wine, they love the grapes.
Yeah, they do. And it's funny, actually, because and like Mother Nature, so quick to adapt to everything that we do, that you know, we've over the years, we've had so many different techniques, from the air cannons, the gas guns, as they call them, which emit three very loud bangs every 20 minutes to scare the birds, to hawk kites, and to you know, kids' windmills on stuck on sticks, and to disco balls, and you know, just everything conceivable to get the birds thinking there's activity, there's people, something's going on in the vineyard, to scare them away. But the outcome of that is, of course, that eventually they figure it out and they get back to their eating.
Yeah, like you say, Toby, it's quite fascinating how, you know, we try and the birds then, I mean, it's interesting, in the old days when the grandsons were young, we'd have little bird houses, and the cute birds would come into their houses, and everybody, aren't they cute, and they're lovely, and taking pictures. And then 7 months later, you're trying to kill them.
It is.
Now, those who know Toby will know, or may not know, that he's a vegetarian. And so you can imagine, you know, in those first days that we came, and we had gas guns, and again, natural world evolves, adapts. So to begin with, the gas guns would go, and the birds would then fly away, and it would do. But then they realize, hey, what's all this? Why are we worried? Let's go back. Nothing's happened. So, you know, that works for a little while. Then you have to change tactic. And then, as Toby said, we'd have big hawk kites in the vineyard. Like, and one day, actually, it was quite amusing. With the, we had them up, and the kite was flying. It was great. And there was a huge gust of wind, and this thing took off, and I think was flying around Marlborough, wasn't it? I mean, in the village.
And actually, we had our name on it. Actually, what happened was that it snapped off its wire and actually disappeared. We could just see a little dot going in towards the village. And then we had a call the next day with someone who wanted to drop something back to us, and we, you know, we said, that's great, what is it? They said, well, we'll bring it around tomorrow. And they arrived, and what had happened was, it was a lovely couple sitting in the square having a picnic, and suddenly a dark shadow loomed over them, and this giant hawk landed on them, and lucky for us, not so lucky for them. I think they may have needed to resuscitate one of them. They brought this kite back to us because it had our name on it. But
picture it, it's like a Batman, you know what I mean? Some giant bat. I mean, it's not a tiny kite that you'd play with your kids or that, you know. This is a mammoth kite. So this couple in the square would have looked up wide-eyed and open-mouthed and horror-stricken to see this Batman type huge monster, like from out of nowhere, out of space, out of their hell, their worst nightmares, swooping towards them as if in attack to like bite them or something. And so it's quite extraordinary. And and Toby, then we tried, I mean, again, some of the listeners who are gardeners will possibly may or may not, in the old days, my mum and dad, my mother particularly, who was into the Mother Nature and the natural world, used to love growing different things, and we'd put milk top bots. They were like silver paper to scare off the birds, and so you know, we tried that with different silver to blind the birds. So Toby had asked me, there was a big disco ball, and he thought that would be a good idea, and I had my doubts, but I thought, okay, well, I'll let them go and see if it works. So in the middle of the vines, once the kite wasn't working, we put up this gigantic disco ball, and I had this vision. It was like Saturday Night Fever, you know. I could imagine these birds saying, what a bunch of weirdos, what a bunch of idiots. You know, that big hawk, that's not going to defeat us. The gas guns won't get us. We want those grapes. And they'd be sitting on their perches in the trees and on the telegraph wires looking down. And then I would imagine what they would have thought to see this gigantic ball like out of some major disco. And you can imagine like John Travolta, you know, doing their, they're dancing, just singing, na, 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 you know. And then they'd come in, and rather than blinding it, did it work, Toby? Maybe for a week or two.
Yeah, I think for a short period of time it worked, but they got used to it, and then they quite liked it, I think.
That's right. Then the grandsons would be sent out with pots and pans, and they'd be smashing on those, and that kind of worked for a while. And then the birds get used to the kind of routine, and they'd come back again, and nothing was seeming to work. So I said to Toby, because some of the other vineyards do live ammunition, and you have to be very careful. So we had to go through this course where you'd stick a gun in Toby's hand, and you'd send him off into the vines, and I'd hear a shot and then a scream. And I wasn't sure if it was the bird screaming or probably Toby who fainted, because he's a vegetarian killer. And of course, that was too hard for you, wasn't it, Toby?
It was very conflicting, but it did. I mean, it was it's an amazing, just the different processes and the different things. I've still got plans to this day, but I think, again, you've told us that perhaps we should just stop worrying so much and just let them do their thing. What do you call it? You call it tithe.
Yes, it's tithe. I mean, basically on that, and again, it's quite interesting that, and each season it's the same, you know, that when you observe Mother Nature and you see the natural world and the animal life, the bird life, they all adapt and evolve in much the same way that, I mean, some of the birds at that point, if you put a dead carcass of a bird on a post, they seem to know, you know, or they seem to think, oh my God, there is danger here. And that kind of works for a while, but then it's the cats, isn't it, Toby? The cats, you send out some of our vineyard cats and they'll protect it, don't they? I mean, it's eat or be eaten. And so in the end, I again, like before, so I said to Toby, look, you know, let's just give the birds something back. And otherwise, you know, it's opportunity cost. It's, you know, you can't alter it. You can't worry about it. You're going to get ill. There's too much stress. Let's write it in. Let's give 10%. Let's assume 10% in our business plan goes back to the birds. And we'll call it tithe. You know, where you give something back, and that's what we do. So we don't get too hung up on it anymore, and just again accept it and adjust for it and plan for it. And as long as we get enough, that we're happy. And so Toby, in the growing, that's the bird section. Then it starts to nothing much happens till March, does it? Really, I mean, we have to monitor them, watch them, watch out for disease, and then the most exciting time comes where we then start doing what's called brick tests. And if you could explain that, Toby.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of vineyards will get very scientific, and a lot of what we learned here and a lot of what Ray's taught us is that the two things you need to know: the sugar. It's very important to find out what the sugar is in the grapes, and also just whether you like the flavors. So those are the only two things that we really concentrate on just before picking. So we do what's called a Brix test, which is the volume of sugar in the grape at the time of the test. And that's basically done by sort of random picking bunches of the same varietal in one block, pressing them, and then just testing the juice to see what the sugar levels are. And then also, you know, the sugar level might be, you know, borderline, but the flavors might be amazing, in which case we'd get the royal thumbs up and we'd pick anyway. So that's really the only things we concentrate on. I think it can be quite scientific, but I think that we've always just tapped into to Mother Nature and the more sort of elemental aspects of it rather than the scientific part.
Yeah, it's interesting really that a lot of the winemakers, and including some of our own, and we respect and admire and applaud their expertise. And they're drawn to it as a scientific, I mean, we think of it as a gift from Mother Nature. They will think of it as a molecular, scientific kind of, they'll get their isoscopes and they're in the laboratories. And I respect that. There's nothing wrong with that. And many of them are also elemental. I mean, a lot of our winemakers are very much in tune with Mother Nature as well and bring that scientific element to bear. And we always take heed of that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, for better or worse, right or wrong, somebody has to make a decision. And there's a million ways you can do anything. So we do. We rely on the basics, keep it simple. And as Toby said, we'll just pick some of the berries, really, and taste the flavors. And if they taste fine and the kind of brick levels are okay, we'll just go for it. And it seems to have worked so far. Hey, Toby, that so the picking is quite beautiful. It's a lovely for the whole community. Explain how you go about that, Toby.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say, actually, especially at this current time, that I'm aware, obviously, a lot of businesses have had to close, and obviously the restaurants not open and the cellar doors not open here. We've been somewhat blessed with the ability to actually complete our harvest under the essential services. I think they're obviously aware that the crop would be lost otherwise, And hopefully at some point down the line, people will be out and wanting to drink hopefully some good wine again. But so we've been somewhat lucky in as much as we're able to pick this crop, whereas a lot of people wouldn't be able to do the jobs that they do in normal life. But what we will do is we'll put together a little team. Again, with the fact that we don't use the big machines, the process takes a bit longer, but it just means that we can be more select. So we'll hopefully, if all goes to plan, be picking some Pinot Noir this coming weekend. And in doing so, we've a very reduced team, and we'll all be in different parts of that block within perhaps 5 or 6 meters apart. And we'll be picking hopefully a couple of tons of Pinot if all goes to plan. And from there, that's done with the little handheld snips. And we basically just pick into bins. And all of those bins are filled. And then at the end of the day, usually we would pick up as we go along. But because of the process and the health and safety required during this time, all of the bins will be left. And then myself and Jake and Dylan will be picking those bins up at the very end of the day after the other team have gone.
I mean, it's an interesting situation because in normal life, people react. You heard the song, I heard it through the grapevine. I mean, that's where people are picking and talking and celebrating and having lunches together and breaks. And it's since time began, man and woman have harvested their crops and give thanks to the natural world for that, whatever crop that might be. And so for the community of Martinborough, it's always, there's a collective consciousness that everybody knows what somebody else is up to, each vineyard. It's a special time, and we always hope that everybody is getting a good crop because, we're not in competition with each other. We want everybody to be sustainable and to succeed. But this year, it's a weird, weird year. And it's interesting, Toby, you're right in the sense that we're able to get the harvest, but not all the harvest, because normally we'd be looking at maybe 12, sometimes 15, 18 tons. But we're only going to be taking this year this week you're going to be doing maybe a ton and a half, 2 tons if you're lucky. And that's on top of maybe 3 tons that you were doing the day that you were in lockdown. So we'll be losing quite a few, probably 70-80% of our crop this year. And as a result of this virus. Because our ultimate aim, for all that it's a commercial imperative, and it is, it's like anything else, like the country, we have to put ourselves and our staff, and we're custodian of their safety and well-being, and that always comes number one. And that's why we had no hesitation whatsoever to the minute, this all came about, we just kind of adjusted and stopped, and And Toby was saying the other day that should we, and I said no, that, you know, not to bring, you know, our staff were isolated, and because it's there was a debate whether or not viticulture was an essential service like farming, and fortunately the Wine Institute and the powers to be were able to get sanction from the government that it is an essential business, so our workers are able to come to the vineyard, but there's a degree of fear and unease and anxiety, and so we're kind of chilling out on that, aren't we, Toby? We're taking a kind of a pragmatic approach, and to think, well, if we can get some and to adopt the safety protocols of social distancing and all that that entails, you know, with because we we're not going to go full steam ahead, and we'll just take what we can and then take it on the chin and move on. And I have to say, like, I echo Toby's, you know, in addition to physical health, fiscal health is, money doesn't, as I say, bring happiness, but the lack of money brings enormous unhappiness. And I feel terribly sorry for those who are, you know, whether they're in business or just laid off or lost their job or on reduced salaries. It's awful time fiscally, and I, you know, my heart goes out to the little businesses that are struggling, and the women and men and mums and dads who are worried about how they pay their mortgage or if they'll have a job. And so we all hope you're not struggling and sustaining and getting on okay. Certainly it's been a worrying time for us, and we've had some meetings, but we'll get through. And as we do, you've got to adopt a positive, do something positive about it, not to anything is possible, but we look at what's probable. And what's probable is that we'll get back in business. You know, I'm estimating that for the next 3 months, it's going to be a bit strange, possibly 6 months, but I would hope round about September, October, we're back to so-called normal, although it'll take a little while for it to kind of calm down, and then we'll be fine.
So, Toby, some of the listeners might be interested in how many bottles of wine do you get in a ton?
Well, we work on a sort of a pretty standard guideline, depending on the varietal, but obviously the one that we work with most is Pinot Noir. So for a ton of Pinot Noir, we get about 800 bottles.
800 bottles. And then, again, just to end the process, that once you've got the all the grapes off the vines and you deliver them to the winery, and then the white wines will sit in a tank for how long?
Well, the white wines we tend to turn over quite quickly because our customers, clients, friends of Tirohana like to drink those wines very, very quickly. So we'll pick them in, say, March. Obviously, this year a little bit different, but and then we'll hopefully have those in the bottles by September, October.
And that's a bit of a totally different process, of course, with the reds, where we have to barrel them, so that can alter the flavors as well. We can do some things in the flavors, but the red wines, explain that process, Toby.
Well, again, depending on the styles that you want to produce, so we do, as you know, a range of different Pinot Noirs. We do a light fruity style, the easy drinking style, and then we do the more complex layered style, which, a Pinot Noir the emphasis is on the fruit, you would give it a reduced period of time in oak. So you can go from anything from 4 months to 8 months. And then for the more complex layered wines with the longer cellaring capacity, you're looking at usually a minimum of 12 months in oak. And that's basically how we've always produced our wines. Sometimes we do special editions. We did a wine, I think, that you designed back in 2005, the Platinum Grand Master, which I think most people would remember. One barrel, 297 bottles, and that was a very special wine. It had a very special barrel brought in from Burgundy, and then that went from one barrel at the end of a 12-month period into another barrel to sort of ease it in. So that was in total about 16 months.
And that's what's fun when we're not in kind of mass production, so to speak, that we can do these limited editions, and You know, we try and not make the same wine twice, if that makes sense. Once something has happened, it tends to be extinct, and it's a miracle, really, the whole process. And again, that's thanks to Mother Nature. But and then once the when we're bottling, maybe just to explain that process as well, it gets delivered to the bottling plant, the wine, when it's ready.
That's right. So the tanks are taken, so all wine would be removed from the barrel at this stage and put into a tank for transporting. So that would be the red wines. And then they would be taken to the bottling plant. It's an amazing process. And there's actually a couple of lovely videos up on our Facebook page from the bottling back in the beginning of March, I think. And also a previous bottling, I think, before Christmas. And it's the engineering feat, the genius of those machines. It's just fascinating. I never get bored of watching them. But yeah, the process is that all the bottling is done in one spot. So the bottling, the screw caps, and then they're all transported from the bottling plant at the end to our storage. And then we bring them in as and when required, week by week, and label them here.
And they're all hand labeled.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. And that's where we're luckily we've got some of our team that are very good at this. Obviously, because of our drinking habits, Ray, they might go on a little bit sort of on a slant. But the younger ones have a keen eye for this, and they go on beautifully.
Yes, it's quite amazing. This. Well, that's the seasons, and you know, from beginning to end. And I hope you listeners have enjoyed that, and it might kind of while away a bit of an hour while you're all in lockdown, and before I pass over to you, Toby, to wrap it up, I'd just like to wish all the listeners all the very best, and to stay calm, stay safe, stay happy, and stay drinking. This is the time that we've got to enjoy. We don't have to drive anywhere, so I'm enjoying the opportunity to have a couple of glasses. And so all my very best to you all, and I'll hand you over to you, Toby, to wrap it up. And until the next time, all the very best.
Thank you, Ray, and thanks for taking the time to speak again. And also thanks to you all for listening. We've actually just drawn our first competition. The lucky winner was Claire Alexander. I've already sent a lovely bottle of wine to her. We're running our second competition now, which is we're hoping to obtain some beautiful pictures of our bottles of wine with you, your favourite bottles of wine from Tirahana. And that competition is now running on Facebook with a massive response. So do keep sending in those wonderful pictures, and we will look forward to catching up with you via Facebook, via emails and calls. We're available all the time. Hopefully we'll speak with you all very, very soon, and in the meantime, take care and stay safe.